Good afternoon. I see Mr. Stummy and Ms. Bartz have joined us, and I want to make sure that we can hear each other. So, Ms. Bartz, can you say something, please?
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Stummy.
Good afternoon. Happy Inauguration Day.
Thank you. Then we will get going. We're a little early. Thank you for being on Zoom, like you're instructed to do. You'll each have 15 minutes and 5 minutes rebuttal for Ms. Bartz if you choose to use it. Please state your name at the start of your argument and who you are representing because we are recording these hearings. And with that, Madam Marshal, will you please call the case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding. Calling the case of the State of Minnesota versus Mullen, court file numbers A20-0305 and A20-0310.
Thank you, Ms. Bartz. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Andrea Bartz and I represent Dane Mullen. Mr. Mullen appealed from the judgment of conviction and the state appealed from his stayed 216-month sentence. Today, I'd like to focus on the sentencing issue. Here, the district court imposed a top-of-the-box 216-month sentence and then chose to stay that sentence and place Mr. Mullen on probation based on its finding that he was particularly amenable to probation. A defendant's particular amenability to probation is a valid mitigating factor that justifies a downward dispositional departure. Here, the district court exercised its broad discretion to depart downward based on that valid factor, and the district court fulfilled its obligation under the sentencing guidelines to put the basis for the departure in writing. This court will rarely review the trial court's, rarely reverse the trial court's decision to depart. In fact, this court will not reverse the trial court's decision to depart unless the reason for the departure is improper and the record does not support the reason for the departure. And that's in Williams versus State, which is also cited in Soto.
So, Ms.
here,
Bartz, what significance, if any, is there to the fact that the transcript would indicate the district court judge really made no findings regarding particular amenability during the sentencing hearing, but then later in the departure report expounded on that? Is there significance to the failure to address those specific factors at the actual hearing?
Well, I think at the hearing, it was clear based on defense counsel's arguments and the memorandum that they were all talking about particular amenability to probation. And under the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines, Section 2D1C, the reasons for the departure, particular amenability, can be placed on the record or in writing. And the court did fulfill its obligation under the guidelines by doing the departure report, listing particular amenability as the basis for the departure, and then all the other reasons to support its finding of particular amenability. So none of the requirements for reversal are met in this case. The district court gave the proper reason, and then Mullen's particular amenability to probation is supported by the record. The departure report provided a lengthy list to support the reasons that the court found him particularly amenable. The departure report said in the past 10 years, and then it listed that he successfully completed a long period of supervision. He had no other offenses. He was consistently employed. He gained custody of his daughter, and he had been in a positive, committed relationship. The departure report also listed the psychosexual evaluation, which found protective factors that mitigated Mr. Mullen's risk of recidivism and recommended individual therapy. So these reasons were supported by the record. We can look at Mullen's psychosexual evaluation, which recommended individual therapy. On page 7, it states he had changed his lifestyle, matured into an active and productive member of the community, and then recommended, quote, individual therapy with a therapist who had a good understanding and experience working with people who had committed sexual offenses, end quote. So the licensed psychologist clearly recommended individual treatment in the community, which means treatment on probation. And the psychologist noted the protective factors that lowered Mullen's risk. And then some of these protective factors are facts that support the court's finding of particular amenability. The record also reflects that Mullen attended sex offender treatment individual therapy in the community before sentencing. And he went to Emergence Behavioral Health. And his treatment confirmation and progress update states that the therapist didn't see any issues with him being able to successfully complete individual therapy to address his past problematic sexual behaviors. So this too supports the court's finding of particular amenability to probation. The state argues that some of the reasons that the court used to conclude Mullen was particularly amenable should not be used because they're factors that, according to the guidelines, should not be considered. But the district court didn't use those reasons as the direct basis for the departure. In Soto, the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized that facts that cannot themselves justify a departure can be relevant to determining whether a defendant is particularly amenable to probation. And that's Soto at 312. So for instance, the court didn't base its departure on whether Mr. Mullen was employed at the time of sentencing. The court noted that he had been consistently employed for years, which was relevant to her determination that he was particularly amenable to probation. It was relevant along with many of the other factors that she considered before concluding that he was particularly amenable. So for instance, the fact that he worked with social services to gain custody of his child and that he had been in a positive, committed relationship for years were also relevant to determining whether he was particularly amenable to probation. Again, citing Soto at 312, because they explain. Yes.
I don't want to stop you from your argument. I do have a couple of other technical questions sure. beyond the sentencing issues. I mean, one of the questions that I had was, it appears to me that your client has convictions entered for 3 first degree criminal sexual conduct counts when there's one for one offense, right?
Yep.
Convictions entered for all one. 3. And the second issue that you raise in your brief regarding count 2 with respect to the incorrect jury instructions. If we vacate count 2, we don't have to address the merits of the incorrect jury instruction, correct?
Well, I'd still ask that you address it.
Why
because
would
I'm asking for a new trial for that.
So say we
because he's still convicted based on the jury verdict.
But if we vacate the conviction and put it in as an unadjudicated or direct the entry of an unadjudicated conviction, then there's no criminal history score. There's no conviction entered.
But he's still been found guilty by the jury of that count. So I raise it and ask that it be addressed on the merits, please. On my conclusion page, I listed my methods of relief, the remedy that I'm requesting. So sufficiency on counts 1 and 2, new trial on, or excuse me, sufficiency on counts 1 and 3, new trial on count 2.
Yeah,
otherwise,
I'm familiar.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So back to what I was saying about his particular amenability. Basically, the district court's considering these facts not as direct basis for departure, but because they're relevant to the court's conclusion that Mr. Mullen's particularly amenable. So that they explain why he would be motivated to succeed on probation, excuse me, and his status as a father is similar to considering the support of family and friends. And there was the support of family and friends in the record here. It showed support of his wife, his mother, and his aunt. So these are relevant factors for the court to use to determine amenability, particular amenability. And then the other factors the court can use to determine particular amenability are his prior record, cooperation, and attitude in court. For his prior record, the court determined he had successfully completed probation, and that period was over 8 years long. The court also found he had been convicted of, or not been convicted of any other offenses. His last offense was for a gross misdemeanor committed on June 3rd of 2008, which is before the alleged offense in this case. And then at the sentencing hearing, the court recognized that this long period of supervision had helped Mr. Mullen and changed him for the better. This court shouldn't be persuaded by the state's argument that Mullen committed this offense weeks after being released from prison in Wisconsin, because the record does not reflect the date that Mullen was released from prison in Wisconsin. Page 3 of the psychosexual evaluation just says release in 2007. And the PSI says he was sentenced to 18 months on January 5th of 2007. But if we run out 18 months, then he would have still been in prison at the time of this offense. So I don't know where the state gets the dates, but I don't have anything other than released from prison in 2007. The record also reflects that he was cooperative. He made all of his court appearances. He complied with conditional release and had a good attitude in court. The state argues that Mullen's lack of remorse shows that he's not particularly amenable to probation, but remorse is just one of the factors that the court considers, and it's not a prerequisite for finding Mr. Mullen particularly amenable to probation, and that is Soto at 311. Finally, at sentencing, the court stated it did not think that a lengthy period of incarceration was going to make society any safer. The court stated the way to protect society was to allow Mr. Mullen to serve 1 year in jail and then comply with probation, including sex offender treatment. So this was unlike Soto. That's why I mention it, because unlike Soto, in which the trial court did not find public safety would be served by placing Soto on probation, here the district court did. Then the district court in this case followed the probation officer's recommendation and put Mr. Mullen on probation for 15 years. The court said it wasn't being lenient when it imposed the top of the box sentence of 216 months, 15 years probation, 1 year in jail, completion of sex offender treatment, and completion of 3,600 hours of community service. All of the facts listed by the court and found in the record distinguish Mullen from others and support the court's finding that he is particularly amenable to probation. The district court acted well within its discretion when it stayed Mullen's sentence, and we'd ask this court to affirm that sentence.
Ms. Bartz, I do have a question. One of the factors relied on by the court in their written order was that your client had stopped using illicit chemicals, which probably was significant since at least alcohol was alleged as a significant factor in the original crime. But I believe the state argues that the record actually doesn't support that, that there's record support that your client had continued to illegally use marijuana regularly up to the present. Do you have a response to that?
Yes, I think illicit means illegal. And I believe that a possession of a small amount of marijuana is now a petty, which under 609.02 is not a criminal offense. It's not a crime. But I think what the judge meant is that he had stopped using cocaine, methamphetamine, and had made significant strides, and he's on probation, so he can't use anything anymore. So he will be monitored for 15 years. But even without that finding, there's ample reason in the record to affirm the district court's finding that he's particularly amenable, especially based on the psychosexual evaluation, which recommends individual therapy in the community.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'd just like to mention a couple things about my issue one, which pertains to counts one and three, where I argue the state was required to prove Mullen and his accomplice used force or coercion.
I was going to ask you about how you think the Middleton case applies to this case.
Thank you. I would like to note that Middleton was charged with fourth degree criminal sexual conduct in 1984 for using coercion to accomplish sexual contact. And when Middleton was decided, the definition of coercion did not include, quote, that causes the complainant to submit to sexual penetration or contact, end quote. So in 1984, the definition of coercion ended with the word another. So in 1984, under Minnesota statute 609.341, subdivision 14, defined coercion as words or circumstances that cause the complainant reasonably to fear the actor will inflict bodily harm or hold in confinement the complainant or another, and then it ended. So language that says that causes the complainant to submit to sexual penetration or contact was not added until 2005. So here there's no evidence of coercion as currently defined under section 609.341, subdivision 14. The state argues that the other man grabbing her arm down to the sand is force and coercion. But that's not force because there's no infliction, attempted infliction, or threatened infliction by Mullen or the other man of bodily harm on AB. AB testified that no one said anything and she didn't testify she felt pain or was hurt during the alleged offense. So there's also no evidence of coercion because there was no evidence that Mullen or the other man used words or circumstances to make her reasonably fear that they would inflict bodily harm on her to accomplish the penetration. She didn't say she was afraid that she would be hurt.
But you're not arguing, at least I didn't see it in your briefs, you're not contesting that there was penetration and a personal injury.
That's correct.
Okay.
So we'd ask this court to reverse Mullen's convictions because the state failed to prove the element of force or coercion, and the alternatively ask the court to affirm the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Mr. Stummy?
Thank you. And may it please the court, the state will also want to focus on the sentencing issue. It is clear that a sentencing court has...
Please state your name for the record.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Nathaniel Stummy for the state of Minnesota in the St. Louis County Attorney's Office. The state will focus on the sentencing issue. It is clear that a sentencing court has great discretion in sentencing and in determining...
Stummy, before you get there, I am curious if you think that the jury instruction, so issue number two, should be different after Ezeka. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce the name of that case.
Your Honor, I've been pronouncing it Ezeka, and I don't think it should be different. I think Ezeka, it's curious that Ezeka is the focus in this appeal because Ezeka actually said that the trial court had not committed plain error, that the hybrid instruction was not against a well-established rule, and simply offered admonishment to future sentencing courts, the trial courts, that the hybrid instruction era had come to an end. And so I don't believe it applies in this case.
But let me, I'm just curious what you think the instruction should be now post Ezeka.
Well, I agree that I guess I'm on the fence, Your Honor, as a practicing attorney. I like a hybrid instruction because I think that it very clearly indicates to a jury both the elements and the accomplice liability theories, and I think there's some risk of confusion when they're separated.
It seems like there could be some risk of plain error if you continue to use hybrid jury instructions.
I see that risk as well, Your Honor.
Mr. Stummy, can I ask you the same question that I asked Ms. Bartz? And that is, if we agree with you that the warrant of commitment should be corrected to remove the adjudications for counts two and count three as duplicative as to count one, do we need to address the merits of the jury instruction? Because the conviction will have been vacated.
I do agree that if that's the case, then you don't need to reach the jury instruction issue.
All right, thank you.
May I continue? Can you hear me? Okay, I will continue. I do not agree with counsel that the impermissible bases for the departure were not things that the court relied upon. The court is required to submit the departure report to the Guidelines Commission within 15 days of the sentencing. That departure report has a specific section, of course, that is entitled Reasons for the Departure. And the reasons that were stated in that section are either a misapplication of the law and the guidelines, or they simply get the facts of record wrong. And I'd like to go through them. The departure report starts out with the statement that this was an old case charged out more than 10 years after the offense. This is true, but I'm not sure why that is stated in the reasons for departure section, because there's nothing in the guidelines or the law that indicates that a sentence should be diminished or mitigated by the age of the offense. This case came about as a result of the SACI program, the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative. The city of Duluth received federal funds to look into the backlog of sexual assault kits, and that's how it came about. The age of the case has no bearing on the reasons for a departure. The court went on to say that the defendant had successfully completed a lengthy period of parole supervision and had no other offenses. The facts of record simply don't support this. The record is that the defendant went to prison in Wisconsin for an armed robbery. He was released on parole, and several weeks after he was released from prison, he committed this brutal, violent rape on the Park Point Beach in Duluth. How can it be said that he successfully completed a lengthy period of probation when that is the history? That his very parole started out with a heinous crime. The departure report goes on to say, as the court has indicated, that he stopped using illicit chemicals. I don't agree that the sentencing court was only referring to hard drugs, to narcotics. The court was referring to any illegal drugs. And the fact that it's a petty misdemeanor to possess marijuana in Minnesota is a red herring. We know that. The court was under the belief that Mr. Mullen was clean, and he was not clean. He admitted to the psychosexual evaluator that he had used marijuana daily during the pendency of this case. And so that's nearly the daily use of marijuana for nearly a year. And so that reason for a departure is not based on facts of record. The court went on to say in the reasons for departure that the defendant has been consistently employed. This is an expressly prohibited basis for a departure in the guidelines. In fact, the guidelines goes to the length of separating the employment factors into actual categories, that it's improper to use the impact of sentence on an occupation, the employment history, employment at the time of the offense, employment at the time of the sentencing. All of these are set out as improper bases for a departure. And so that was that reason was prohibited by law. The sentencing departure report goes on to say that he gained custody of his daughter through social services and has been in a positive, committed relationship for many years. Again, the guidelines explicitly prohibit the use of social factors, including living arrangements and marital status, from a departure determination. The court went on to say that the psychosexual evaluation indicates that he has many protective factors that decrease his risk of recidivism despite the nature of this offense, and recommend individual or group therapy. Again, this is a misapplication of law, because those protective factors noted in the psychosexual evaluation are that he had a 4-year live-in relationship with his girlfriend, that he maintained consistent employment, and that he was fighting for the custody of his daughter and raising her. And so referring to the psychosexual evaluation report in this way is simply referring to the prohibited social factors in a repackaged form. It is not proper for the sentencing court to have used this as a basis. And defense counsel, I think, correctly points out that these factors could be used in an argument to say that the defendant is particularly amenable to probation. But I would point out that the psychosexual evaluation, although it notes that these protective factors might mitigate the fact that it found that he was at medium to high risk of reoffense, it might mitigate that, those protective factors did not propel Mr. Mullen into the status of being particularly amenable to probation. The psychosexual evaluation does not state at all in any terms that Mr. Mullen is distinguished from others in his situation as particularly amenable to probation. Simply that those protective factors would mitigate against his possible high risk of reoffense. And then the court concludes in its reasons for departure that, quote, for all of these reasons, he is particularly amenable to probation and sex offender treatment in a local correctional setting rather than with the DOC. Now, I would agree with Judge Flory's suggestion that there could be significance in the fact that the first time we see or hear the word particularly comes in this reasons for departure section of the form that the guidelines require be submitted after a departure. And the court knows that. The court knew that would be the magic word, that is the correct standard of the law. But significantly, the court did not ever mention Mr. Mullen's particular amenability to probation at the sentencing hearing. I think that is significant.
Is there some authority that requires a district court judge to use that magic language during the sentencing hearing? I'm not aware of any case that says that a district court judge must say that a defendant is particularly amenable to probation at the sentencing hearing.
Your Honor, I cannot recall the case that I read, but I believe there's case law that does say the court is not required to specifically say the word particular with regard to amenability. But I think the idea that status of the defendant needs to be articulated in some way that is equivalent to that specific word. So I think the absence of the word is not determinative.
So Mr. Stummy, would it be appropriate for this court to look at the record that was in front of the district court and consider whether or not there were factors set forth in the record that supports the district court's decision, even if not specifically set forth in the district court's sentencing order?
I think it would be appropriate to do so, and I would respectfully submit that the court will not come up with anything beyond what I think the court actually did the best job at putting Mr. Mullen in the most favorable light. And what the state is saying is that light was not bright enough to distinguish him from those similarly situated, those who had also been with his criminal history, had committed a brutal, violent rape. Mr. Mullen does not stand out. And I think that's one of the takeaways of the Soto case. The Soto Supreme Court went to great lengths at talking about the importance and the focus on the word particularly amenable. The court referred to the dictionary definition that it means exceptional, that it sets somebody apart, that it distinguishes an individual from among those who are similarly situated. And I think this court's review of the record will indicate that nothing whatsoever distinguishes Mullen, Mr. Mullen, from those similarly situated. The probation department in their pre-sentence investigation did not highlight anything that sets him apart. The psychosexual evaluation does not set him apart. None of his colloquy, none of his lawyer's arguments, none of the support of his family, all of it, as our brief says, was, and not to diminish the importance of this situation, but it was a run-of-the-mill rape case. Mr. Mullen committed a violent rape. His life circumstances are average. They don't set him apart from anybody else who has committed a violent rape, and he is not entitled to a departure, and we ask the court to reverse.
Thank you. Ms. Bartz, do you have any rebuttal?
Yes, I do. Thank you. So under the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines, Section 2D3A7, list mitigating factors. Number 7 is the offender is particularly amenable to probation. This factor may but need not be supported by the fact that the offender is particularly amenable to relevant program of individualized treatment in a probationary setting. So here we have the court saying he's particularly amenable and cites the psychosexual evaluation, and the psychosexual evaluation says, quote, individual treatment. So the record supports the district court's finding of particular amenability to probation. And the court gave a laundry list in the departure report of the things she considered before making that finding. Trog says particular amenability is a valid mitigating factor and justifies a downward dispositional departure. And then the court fulfilled its obligations under the guidelines, Section 2D1C, to put the departure reason in writing in the departure report. It did that. So this court will rarely reverse a district court's decision to depart. Neither requirement for doing so is met here. In the departure report, the court was simply calling out the fact that in the past 10 years, Mr. Mullen had consistently maintained employment, gained custody of his daughter, all the laundry list. She wasn't saying anything about the offense being old and using that as a reason to sentence Mr. Mullen. She was required to look at Mr. Mullen, the circumstances of his life in the past 10 years in order to depart. And then she did find substantial compelling reasons and departed downward. And the court didn't abuse its discretion when doing so. I'm still unclear where in the record it says that Mr. Mullen was released from prison and then weeks later committed this offense. I don't know where that comes from. The court read the psychosexual evaluation and the PSI and was well informed before imposing the sentence here. And at the sentencing hearing, the court did follow the recommendations of the probation officer and imposed a 15-year probationary sentence. As far as issue 2 about the jury instruction, Ezika does apply to this case for plain error analysis because this court examines the law at the time of the appeal. And that comes from State v. Kelly, cited in my brief. It's 855 Northwest 2nd at 269 at 277. And then for the question about what about vacating counts 2 and 3, and do you have to address this jury instruction issue for count 2? The answer is yes, because if count 1 is ever reversed, he could be resentenced for count 2 because he still has the jury's verdict finding him guilty. So we would ask this court to please address the jury instruction issue under plain error standard, because Ezika is clear. And we look at the time of the law that's in effect at the time of the appeal, excuse me. And then just one more time, Soto recognized that facts that cannot themselves justify a departure can be relevant to determining whether a defendant is particularly amenable. So the court wasn't listing that Mr. Mullen was employed at the time of the offense and that's why it departed. It was considering all the aspects about Mr. Mullen and his life in the past 10 years and listing all the reasons which are supported in the record, to conclude that he was particularly amenable to probation, and that is a valid mitigating factor to support this departure. And we would ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The arguments have been helpful, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days.